difficult to know where to start in a topic such as this, but first of all, I think the proper starting point is to try to visualize ourselves tonight. What are we trying to do? What is our objective? What is our purpose in gathering to study this particular prophecy, the revelation of our Lord Jesus Christ? It seems as though the study of prophecy has been kind of an exciting one among the Lord's people, and there have been many things written, some perhaps proper, but for the most part there has been a lot of harm done by premature and immature writing on the subject, and it's difficult, again, such a setting, to know just how to start or how to qualify ourselves so that we don't get a wrong objective in the study. Unfortunately, there have been mistakes made, I think, in the study of this book, maybe too dogmatic, or maybe not dogmatic enough, or not coming to any conclusions. It becomes nebulous in the minds of the Lord's people. But tonight, I think we have to realize that what we're really trying to do, we're trying to have a meeting of minds. Not among ourselves so much, but what we're trying to do is to have a meeting with the mind of the Lord in His prophetic writings. And I think that's how we have to start this study. In the book of Revelation, we have some things that apparently are on the Lord's mind. Now, we cannot say that these things are not important. If they were not important, God would not have written them for us. If God's mind that is recorded in this book, and so far our efforts have not been complete in having a proper meeting of our minds with the mind of God. If we can picture this, on the one side is God's mind, His prophetic word, revelation, and all the subjects associated with it, and on the other side is us. And between us so far, there is a ravine, or a large crevice. Now, that's our position tonight. We're standing at one side of this crevice, and the mind of God is on the other. And we want to bridge the gap that exists between us and the mind of God. And to start with, we have to realize that there have been many before that have tried to bridge this gap, and some have come to disastrous ends. And usually when we start a study such as this, why, there will be many brethren who will take us to the, more or less, the edge of this crevice, and they'll show us down below the bleached bones of this brother or that brother that tried to bridge this gap that exists between us and the mind of the Lord, and they'll say, now be careful. Now, this is very dangerous. You may be injured. And there may be some truth in that. It can be dangerous if we're careless about our approach to this subject. But at the same time, we feel, and scripturally so, I think, that it is proper for us to desire to have such a meeting of minds. This ravine, this crevice that exists between us can be bridged, and it shall be bridged by the Lord's people, and it is for us to try to bridge this gap so that we can have a meeting of mind. And if we can start our study with this atmosphere, I think it'll give it a more reverent aspect. It's nothing that's light, and it's nothing that we need to minimize because of the dangers. I think that some have been inclined to minimize it. Some have built a barricade, as it were, on this side of the crevice, and they say, oh, no, don't go near this subject because it's just a lot of contention and a lot of trouble comes out of it. Stay away from it. We've got enough truth. We don't need any more. Others made their calling election sure without knowing revelation and so on, so just stay away from it. Well, dear friends, it may be true that others have made their calling election sure in the past without knowing these things, and maybe some of us here will make our calling election sure without knowing some of these things. That part we cannot contend, but the point is, it is important. Otherwise, the Lord wouldn't have written so much about things that must yet come to pass. Now about this barricade. If you have a barricade in your mind and you feel that it's not proper to study the book or that you can't come to any conclusion, then you see it's difficult for us to have any real grounds for discussing this matter any further. If you feel, if any brother feels that, well, you better stay away from it, it's dangerous, and so on and so on, if you have that attitude about this study, well, then it's useless to start, because invariably you wind up with a person running behind his barricade saying, oh, I don't want to get near this subject because it's dangerous, and I'll just stick to what I have, and that's it. And so it's not the purpose of this study. If you feel that barricade in your mind is justified, keep it. We're not going to try to dig anyone out from this barricade. It's for each individual to ascertain whether this barricade is of God or whether it's a false barricade. It's something that sure no one's going to fall over into the crevice if he has this barricade, but neither is he going to have a meeting of minds with the Lord. You've got to choose one or the other. You're either going to be sheltered from revelation, the study of it, or else you're going to have to take the risk. You're going to have to take the effort to bridge this gap. And it's not an easy bridge to gap. We don't want to think that there's a great big highway that all we got to do is get in a chariot and we can go across in a few hours. We can understand what's on the mind of the Lord and His prophetic word. The Holy Spirit never operated that way. It always came to us little by little. And the Spirit, what did the Spirit promise? How is it going to teach us? Was he going to impart all knowledge to us at once, or what was the promise?
Here a little, there a little,
and the Spirit, when he was to come, he was to do what? He was right to guide us gently, little by little. That's the thought. And so there's got to be a starting point. And first of all, we've got to decide whether this barricade that has existed, and I know it's existed in the minds of many of the Lord's people, they feel, well, it's not right. I'll just stay far away from it. We have sufficient and so on. And to them, it's safe. See, well, it's sure it's safe. They're not in any danger getting any wrong concepts of revelation by not studying it. That's true. But likewise, there's no possibility of understanding the mind of the Lord. That's the point we have to realize. It's not really a friend, this barricade that has been built up. It's not getting us to our objective. It's really a hindrance. And I think that maybe the Lord, in the Lord's providence, it is intended to be that way, that these barricades have risen and they become a test to the Lord's people as to whether they want to make the necessary effort to understand His Word. Well, now, then too, in approaching this matter, this is only a limited study. It's not going to be a study like your regular Berean studies every week, where you meet week after week and month after month and year after year, and you have a lot of time to just go over it piece by piece. I wish we did have that much time. This is going to be a short series, and it's the objective of this study is to get a concept, to get a plan, an outline of certain features of revelation in our minds. If we can understand that, to start with, it'll be a help, because if we want to go into endless detail on every matter, it would take literally well, it just could go on and on, and we would never perhaps get over every detail. But the purpose of this meeting is not to iron out every wrinkle, but to try to get a concept of what is in the book of Revelation, particularly starting about the 12th chapter of Revelation on through the 19th chapters. 12 to 19 are the parts that are really the most vital to the church, because they're more concerned with the church that are, which is living in the Spirit on the Lord's day, who are in the Spirit-begotten condition in this millennial day, the day of the Lord. Now, that's the starting point, that's the setting. And from here, we're just going to start in with the 12th chapter of Revelation. But before we start that, who can tell me how many beasts there are in Revelation? There are a certain number of beasts, and I want to know how many there are. That is,
counting the image of the beast as one?
Yes, counting the image. You can name them off. If you can't, you make one, we'll fill it in. Name as many as you have in your mind, that's all.
There's one in the 13th chapter.
What is it?
The leopard.
Leopard mind. Alright, that's one beast. Alright. You mentioned the image of the beast, that's two beasts.
Two horned beasts.
There's a two horned beast, that makes three beasts.
Dragon.
There's a dragon, that makes four beasts. All right.
A scarlet colored
beast. And what color is scarlet?
Red.
There's five beasts in Revelation. Now you see, you can see that there is going to be detail here. These beasts are not given to fill up space. Each one is a particular study. Each one gives us certain information. And they're each one of them different. Now there are three beasts in particular that have a tremendous similarity in one respect. And what three beasts are they? There are three beasts that have one thing in common. One thing in common. Or maybe I should say seven things in common. They have seven heads. There are three beasts in Revelation that have seven heads. But that's the main similarity. The rest of the beasts, at least three, while they have seven heads, they're dissimilar in their description. Now, we'll just take the beasts more or less one at a time, and we won't exhaust each one, I don't think. But just to get a starting point, we'll start with the dragon. That's the first one mentioned. Now, I understand that some of you already had a little study on this a week or two ago, so you should be more or less have this thing fresh in mind. We'll ask someone to read verses 1 through 7. Brother Charles, do you have it there? Revelation 12, 1 to 7.
And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his head. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child, as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought against his angels.
Yes, you might as well read to the 9th verse there. It tells what happens.
And prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil, and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him.
All right, now, here is a great red dragon. Now, Ruthie, do you want to turn on our projector and see if we can get a picture of this? We don't need to turn all the lights off. This will be, I think, sufficient. See if we can get a picture of this dragon that we had described. Here's the dragon. Now, in the first place, where does this all take place? Where did John see this vision? Where was it all transpiring? Yes, it all took place in heaven. The woman was there. The dragon was there. This picture shows the dragon after it is cast down to the earth. But this beast has, as we are told, 7 heads. And it has how many horns? 10 horns. And what's unusual about this beast? Of course, it's unusual. You never see beasts like that. But there, the phenomenal thing about this beast is what?
It has more crowns than head.
No, it doesn't have more crowns than head.
10 crowns?
That's 2 numbers. It has 7 crowns.
It's 10 horns.
It has 10 horns, but it has 7 crowns. And the crowns are upon the head. All right. Now this dragon also has a tail, a long tail, and with it he draws a third part of the stars of heaven and casts them to the earth. Now, the tail, what's a tail? We have a scripture that tells us what a tail is. Isaiah 9:15. Somebody find that page and read it. Read it to me.
Nations are abominable, he is the head, and the prophet that speaks his lies, he is the tail.
Yes. In the Old Testament, the tail was the part that was furious, false. So this tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven, and it cast them. It threw them from heaven to the earth. They didn't necessarily come of their own volition, apparently, from the details here. Now, here's where there's a little variation in perhaps the way I view this, and perhaps others view it. Now, I know the traditional viewpoint of Bible students is that, well, maybe you can tell me. Some of you were at a study last week. How do they understand these stars being drawn by the tail and cast to the earth? Who were they? Do they say these stars were? Were they faithful or were they unfaithful? Do you remember that in your study?
They were the faithful, unfaithful rather.
They said they were the unfaithful. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think, and on scriptural grounds, that they represent the faithful. Not necessarily, when we speak of faithful, you must realize it's a general statement. All of Revelation, for the most part, does not deal with specific saints, that is, with members that make up the 144,000, but they deal with categories who are lighthearted oftentimes and those who are in the wrong condition of heart and mind. Now, it's what part is thrown down? Now, here's the clue. It's a what part? Third. Is it a half? A third part is thrown down. Now, what's a third part? Is there anything in the scriptures that would give us some clue? I mean, we can't be arbitrary about this. Is there some way of knowing what a third part is? You know, it's easy to say, oh, well, a third part represents this or that or the other thing, but there's got to be a clue to what it represents. And for a clue, let us turn to the ninth chapter of Revelation. If somebody will read between the Eighteenth and the 20th verses, there's a strong clue as to what the third part may be. Who has it? 18 to 20. Yes, Revelation 9.
By these things was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone, which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouths and in their tails. For their tails were like unto serpents, and had heads, and with them they did hurt. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship them, but idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk.
Now, maybe that doesn't make any sense to you, but there's a clue there. The Revelator here is dealing, I believe, with the trumpet. I don't know whether offhand whether it's the sixth trumpet or the fifth. But he says that a third part, and this third part comes up repeatedly in Revelation. It even comes up in Zechariah. A third part, remember, is brought through the fire. Now, we're left with one of two conclusions. Either the third part is consistently, it represents one thing, or it, in each instance, it represents something different. Which, if it does represent something different in each instance, then we're at a loss to understand. We believe that the third part always refers to a particular group or type. And you'll notice in this statement you have a one-third and you have a two-thirds. You have a one-third that were killed by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone. Now this was killed to a condition. They were killed just like the tares are killed. They ceased to their condition. But the rest of them, the two-thirds, they weren't reformed. They weren't converted to Christianity. They continued on in their usual course. And he says in the 20th verse, and the rest of the men, that is the two-thirds, which were killed, were not killed by these plagues, that is by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone, repented not of their works of their hands, that they should worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and wood, which neither can see nor hear, neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their sex. There's the two-thirds. They were the part that were unconverted. The one-third were apparently the right-hearted. Does that sound reasonable? I mean, no use, just passing over things that does that register in everyone's mind. The nearest thing to it, I think, is Brother Russell's reasoning on the angels ruling the world that existed before the flood. You know, we don't have any scripture that specifically says that they ruled it. But in Hebrews, the second chapter, it says that God hath not put into subjection unto the angels the world to come, which implies that there was one world that was under the rule of the angels. Isn't that right? That's Brother Russell's reason. Now here, we have a similar situation. We know that the two-thirds were the part that didn't repent of their sorceries and their murders and their wickedness and so on. They represented the pagan, the unbelieving world that continued on in their wickedness, as it were, and not converted to righteousness. Now, this isn't dealing specifically with saints, but it's dealing with mankind, showing what took place in the world at different periods. And notice here, the third part represented a faithful part that were converted. They were right-hearted. They were in the right condition of heart, and they repented of their evil works and so on, and they accepted Christianity. Well, now to go back to Revelation, the 12th chapter, we tried to deviate here just enough to establish what this third part is. And I really think that in Zechariah, the third part that comes through the fire represents the right-hearted among the Jews. We're all familiar with that scripture about the third part he'll bring through the fire. In my mind, that represents the right-hearted Jews that will be brought through the fire in Zechariah. Trying to keep the picture consistent. But what happened in the early church? You see, this all took place in heaven. We want to look at the early church as being in a spiritual condition. The early church were in a position to rule the church, the early saints. That is, to exercise authority in it. I don't mean rule like the papacy did, but they had influence in the heavens. There's where the 12 apostles were, and the sun and the moon were there. But this dragon drew a third part. It drew the faithful leaders in the church and drew them down to the earth. Subsequently, the dragon itself landed on the earth. And subsequently, who else landed on the earth in this picture? Well, the third part of the stars of heaven landed on the earth. Yes. But who else landed on the earth?
The devil.
His angels, and also something else. The woman. She had to flee into the wilderness. She was cast out of heaven too. She lost her place in the heavens, which I think is significant, because here in the early church, apparently the faithful rulers were, if they didn't go along with the powers that existed, they were removed from office. Even during the pagan persecution, if you'll read in your second volume, you'll find that some of the bishops were very influential. Even during the reign of that last tribulation 10 days, who was the ruler then? I forgot.
Diocletian.
Yeah, there were some influential bishops that Diocletian had to reckon with, and the influential ones, who had large congregations and large wealth, they were able to maintain their position in the heavens. It was those who were faithful to the Lord that were thrown out of the ecclesiastical realm. That is, they lost their parishes, they lost their congregations, they were rejected, as it were, through the governmental agencies. Notice this dragon is in heaven. This is not at the time way back when, but this is at a time in which the dragon, starting about Constantine's time, was on the scene, where it was in heaven, and it was already having its hands in the affairs of the church. Of course, when Constantine entered the church, did he accept the headship of the church? Does anyone remember? No, he did not. He entered the church as Pontifex Maximus. He was the chief religious ruler. He wasn't a subordinate. He wasn't a penitent sinner that crept into the church begging for mercy and for forgiveness. He walked in as the emperor, as the ruler, as the one who decided the issues in the church. It was It was Constantine that decided whether the churches today are going to accept the Trinity or whether they're going to accept our concept of God. And Constantine decided that they should believe the Trinity. So they believe the Trinity. That's the way the matters prevailed. He was the one that decided all the issues in the church. Now this, I know, is a little deviation from what was written in Brother Russell's early article, only on that one point as to the third part. In the fourth volume, Brother Russell says that these stars always represent, all but the 12 stars, always represent an apostate element. But there are exceptions, and he didn't mention the exception, but there are 7 stars in the early church, which were not in the early church, but to the Christian church, that were not apostate. They were the 7 messengers to the church. He didn't make that exception, but that's there nonetheless. And I think here is another exception. True, that most of the stars in the heavens were unfaithful. They represent the apostate. But I think the third part, to be consistent with the rest of Revelation, has to represent an unfaithful a faithful element in the church, a right-hearted element, I should say. All right. This woman, who does the woman represent? Speak up loudly, don't be afraid. This is an informal meeting, we're not church. It represents the church, as the early church. And this church, the Apostle Paul tells us, had what in it already, even in his day? Yes, there was that mystery of iniquity, that iniquitous thing. It appears in every period of the church. It started in the Ephesus period of the church, where they had the Nicolaitans that loved the Lord and over God's people and so on. And it went on through every period of the church. So that Antichrist system was there. And the dragon, was he interested in devouring the woman?
No.
Is that what the record says?
No.
You see, during the early pagan persecution, that's almost what it seems like. The early pagan persecution, the dragon was more or less interested in destroying the church. But this takes us, I think, a little beyond that point, to the time where the dragon was in heaven and he was glad to be there, and he was interested in the man-child. He was interested in these prominent bishops, these great religious rulers that were already in the church. He had his eye on them. And what was his idea? At a certain time, apparently, when conditions became ripe, to appropriate all the authority that they had unto himself, and to use this man-child, this thing, to keep it as it were under his thumb, to devour it, to appropriate this man of sin, to work toward the interests of the empire. That's what the record seems to indicate. But to his surprise, when this man-child emerged, when it finally appeared in concrete form, it was like a jack-in-the-box. You know, he was waiting, he had it open, you know, looking to see when it was going to emerge, and when it popped out, it got all together on its hands. And the thing went up to heaven, and it really startled. It really startled the emperors, as it were, the power, the quickness with which they worked, and the way they got into heaven. That's apparently what happened in the early church, and if you study history, you'll see how quickly the thing emerged. The Bishop of Rome, you see, he finally, when Constantine moved his quarters to Constantinople, he dared not put another ruler equal in power to himself over the part that he left over the Western Hemisphere, for fear of what? You know, all the rulers at that time were fearful. Why were they fearful? If they put someone too influential, chances are he would grab up the territory and he would become more prominent than they. So consequently, when Constantine moved the empire, the seat of authority, Constantinople, and that was, you know, shortly after he had acknowledged Christianity and become a Christian, it seems as though he moved to Constantinople, and that left all of Italy open, with only subordinate rulers there. And so what happened? The Bishop of Rome soon arose above all other claimants in power and glory, and he became the head of the church. And that's where it became a man of sin, actually, is when the church accepted an earthly head. When they accepted the Papa as the ruler of the church, that's when the thing, yeah, that's when it was born. That's when the man of sin emerged as such. Otherwise, the church is usually referred to as a woman. But in accepting the headship of the Pope, it became a complete counterfeit of the Antichrist. See, we accept the headship of Christ only. And there is the true Christ. The Christ, the head, and the body member, see? But the Antichrist, a man of sin, emerged when the church accepted an earthly head, which was the Pope. That's my brother Oscar says in Volume 2. All right, now, apparently there was a struggle. The man of sin rose in power to the point where the dragon was not in a position to divest it any more of its power. It had gained such influence that even the emperors could no longer keep this thing in subordination. They could no longer appropriate to themselves the power of the church. The church began to appropriate to themselves the power of the state. That's what happened here. That's what the war is about in this 12th chapter of Revelation. You know, it was a case of who's who. And it turned out that the church became the big fish in the pond, as it were. They became so influential that they were a power to be reckoned with by the emperor. And that accounts for the war in heaven. Now, is there any question up to this point? You know, feel free to speak. This isn't a closed meeting by any means, but if you have any questions as we go along, anything that isn't clear to you, why, just ask.
Did I miss your thought on caught up to God?
I know I didn't mention that part yet. That's a part of, that is of considerable interest. It says that this man-child was caught up to God and to his throne. Now, if we say that this man-child is the man of sin, how is it that it is caught up to God and to his throne? Does anyone remember? Brother Russell explains this. All. I mean, this is nothing new particularly. This study is one that Brother Russell has perhaps written as much on. Maybe the leopard-like beast he has written a little more on. But those two beasts, the dragon and the leopard-like beast, are the two that he goes into considerable detail on. Brother Hummel?
What I read in the comments I have here is referred to Pope. Where God may refer to the Pope.
Well, yes, that's right. That basically is what happened. But we have a scripture in Thessalonians, I think, that explains just what happened here. In 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, the third through the seventh verses. Brother Stuart, do you have that, please?
Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there be a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that while I was yet with you I told you these things? And now ye know that, now ye know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth will let, until he be taken out of the way.
Yes. Now, who is this here that opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is God, and sitteth in the temple of God, and saith that he is God? Oh, it's the Pope. He makes all of those claims. He sits in the temple of God, and Daniel shows that this abomination that maketh desolate would be standing in the holy place. Our Lord's great prophecy says the same thing, standing in the holy place where it ought not to be standing. It had no business there, but it was there just the same. It defiled the temple. It defiled the sanctuary class, the church class. That's what happened in the church. Now, what does Michael mean? Where's Michael?
Pardon?
Who has God?
Who has God? Now, what does Thessalonians say? What does it say? It says, who has God? And what does Revelation say about Michael? And there was war in heaven and Michael. This one who was as God fought, and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon fought and his angels. See, once this man of sin emerged, and once the Pope became influential, then it became a struggle between the emperors and the Pope. There wasn't exactly a pleasant relationship that existed between them by any means. The church has always had a troubled existence with the state. The Pope that Napoleon dethroned, he wasn't the first Pope that got chased off the throne. There were others that got chased off the throne before him. intermittently, there was always this friction, but there was a point when finally Michael succeeded in casting out the dragon out of where? Out of the ecclesiastical realm. In other words, after time, it wasn't Constantine who decided what the church was going to believe, was it? It was all right when he entered the church. He decided about in the Nicene Creed and so on. He had all the bishops come before him, and he heard their cause, and then he decided in favor of the one creed and so on. It was all right. See, but later, the emperors were not called upon to decide the matters that pertain to the church. Who decided matters in the church? The Pope decided it. And that meant that the dragon was cast out. Well, now, up to this point, we haven't said who the dragon was. Who is the dragon?
Civil power.
It represents the civil powers, that's right. Brother Hummel?
Before you go into that dragon, I was wondering why in the fifth verse, that word God is written with a capital G, and I noticed in the diagram, all three letters are capital letters. I was wondering
it's just the word theos. It's God. It's, that doesn't mean that it's... I don't think the article whole theos appears there. It doesn't say the God, does it?
No, not in the Greek.
No. It's just theos, and there be many gods. Ye are gods. And I don't know whether the capitalization, whether they Well, it would be up to the translators, more or less, as to how they capitalized it. So I don't think that that would have much of a bearing on it. It's a title. And any title, a title of respect, would have to be capitalized, even according to the English writing. All right, now we say that this dragon represents the civil power. Now, some of the earlier writings said that it represents the pagan power. But which of the two would be more correct, do you think? Does it represent pagan pagan Rome, or does it represent civil Rome?
Civil Rome.
Yes, it would represent civil Rome. Now there's strong reason why we have to interpret this civil instead of pagan. Because this dragon is a long-lived thing. This dragon is still living, whether you know it or not. Still around. It's not dead and buried by any means. And for proof of this matter, all you got to do is turn to the 16th chapter of Revelation. Verse 13. Somebody have it? Read it, please.
And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet.
Now, do you think it's the same dragon, or do you think that's another kind of dragon? You think it's the same one? I think so too. There's not two dragons in Revelation, there's just one. Now, let's get onto these heads. Seven heads. What do you think a head represents? No.
Government.
Doesn't represent a ruler. Now there is a ruler that comes up later, but that's in another connection. A head represents what?
Government.
A particular form of government. Now, in a picture, you see, if you wanted to show the element of time, how would you do it? You know, in other words, if you wanted to show that this beast goes through successions of governments, how could you do it? Simply by showing that the beast just doesn't have one head. Now, in fact, in reality, we know that the beast, this dragon, doesn't have seven heads all at one time. I mean in the actuality. These heads are, as it were, they can be replaced, and one head has replaced another. That's really how in history it has worked out. The head started off about the time of Constantine. That's where one of your heads starts. That would be, I would say, the first head, because this appears in heaven. This is the heavens where the woman was. This is the heaven where the stars were. This is the heavens where the sun was. And this is the heaven where the dragon is in. So it doesn't start way back when, before Constantine entered the church during the pagan persecution so much. This account really isn't so much concentrating on the pagan persecution. You know, the dragon, you must remember, wasn't trying to devour the woman. That's what the record states. It was trying to devour the man-child. Which, in the pagan persecution, or in the early church, they were bent on destroying Christianity as a whole. And, first of all, they started by casting out of authority, under Constantine's time, those that went along with the Arian viewpoint began to lose their bishoprics. They began to lose their influence, and this dragon was casting them down to the earth, where gradually the woman landed, and finally where he landed himself. Of ecclesiastical, without voice in the ecclesiastical heavens, without authority in it. And so these heads, now there's nothing in this account to tell us what these heads are. In other words, I'm going to tell you arbitrarily here, but it's not arbitrary. There's another study in which I hope to give you some basis of reasoning as to identifying these heads, and that's in the 17th chapter. We get a clue as to where these heads start and the different ones that exist. But I'll name them offhand. The first one starts off with the Constantinian Empire. And then it went on up until the time of Valentinian. When Constantine died, the empire was divided among his sons, and it became known as the Western Empire. That's the second one, the Western Empire. And these are substantiated in history. You don't find them there as heads and so on, but they do speak about the changes that took place in the Roman Empire. And then, under Valentinian, certain concessions were made to the church and so on, and it continued that way up until the time about 539, a well-established point in history and in the volumes. You're all familiar with the date 539. That's when Justinian recognized the Pope as the head of all the churches, and that's when the Arians were defeated, they were put down, and it became the Byzantine government. From the east, Justinian spread his empire over the west, and he succeeded in enthroning the Pope over both the east and the west. So that Arianism from that date was doomed to the pit, as it were. All right, that's the second, third head, the Byzantine government. And that, I think, is an easy one. I think everyone would agree on that one. And then the next one is one that there's no controversy, I don't believe, about. And that's the fourth head, which takes us to the time of Charlemagne, when he instituted the Holy Roman Empire, which was by far the most glorious head of all, and the one that held sway the longest period of time. And then, from that head, you come on to the fifth one, which was the Napoleonic reform. And that brought a new change of government in the Roman Empire. And it became entrenched under the Napoleonic rulers that followed Napoleon. There's where your fifth head emerged. The seventh head, now here is a little variation too from what Brother Russell says. I'm trying to be honest on this. I want to let you know where there are deviations from what Brother Russell has written, so that you'll know that when I say Brother Russell agrees with a certain point, likewise we want to be honest. We don't want to be dishonest about trying to represent things. There is a little variation, and we'll get into this more. I'm just giving you a rough sketch of these heads, because I believe that the heads on all of these beasts are the same. They cover the same periods of time. If you get the heads on this dragon straight, it applies to the leopard-like beast, and it applies likewise to the scarlet-colored beast. They all fit into the same successions of government. That's what the head represents, a succession of government. A vital change, a form of government that held sway in Rome for a given period. The fifth one was the Napoleonic head. And then you come to the Victor Emmanuel rule, which was the seventh, which was the sixth rather, and they finally, we submit, the Nazi fascist regime was the last headship form of government in Rome, which had, as it were, universal dominion over the Roman Empire. Now that is somewhat arbitrary, but we'll get into that more. We won't labor this point now. We'll get into that in the 17th chapter. All right, now these heads have crowns. And do you think that this dragon had a right to have a crown on its head? Does the civil powers, does the Roman civil power have a right to rule? Did it have a right to rule?
Didn't they have a right until he came with right away?
Yes, that's right. But divorcing this a little bit, even from the Gentile dominion, when the Lord took away the government from Israel, it was to be, as it were, turned over to the Gentiles, the Gentile dominion. But I don't think that this picture is just that detailed, because I think that one of the heads goes beyond the Gentile dominion. But it shows that this civil government had the real authority. It was the one that, in God's predetermination, was to rule. They were to rule in the earth. They weren't supposed to be in heaven. That isn't the thought. This beast wasn't given the crown to be in heaven. That isn't the thought so much. But this beast, the civil government of Rome, was a proper one. In other words, civil governments do have a right to exercise authority in the earth. And that's their legal right. And we expect governments to exist on the earth until finally the government of Christ holds sway over the earth. It is proper that these governments, these kings and rulers, should exist, and that they are the proper ones to hold sway in the earth, not the church. We realize that from God's standpoint, the church has no business in ruling the earth. But they do anyway. All right. Are we getting down to about the end of our tapes here? No, there's a little more. Yep. Now, are there any questions up to this point? Anything that seems a little bit hazy and not clear? Sister Alpha?
The reason that there are seven heads is just to show. Actually, there's only one head at a time.
That's
in
right.
Fact,
In actuality, there was only one succession of government in authority at a time. But in a picture, you know, in a picture you're limited. It's a beautiful thing. You can convey so much in a picture, and yet you have to be wise, in other words, in understanding and using it. Now, notice this beast has horns. How many horns does it have?
Ten.
10 horns. And you see, the artist here had a problem. If he put 10 horns on each head, how many horns would that have made? That would have made 70, you see. So you couldn't do that. In other words, John apparently saw something like this in vision. He saw something in his mind, and he tried to describe it. And that's what we've been trying to do. Brother Harry has gone through considerable effort, and I think he did a beautiful job, and it's very, I think, accurate, showing the details. The only place these horns could be, so that there would be 10 of them, is on the body of the beast. So that even when the head passed off the scene, the beast still had 10 horns. See? That remained stationary, as it were. But here again, it's a general picture. We mustn't think that Rome had 10 forms of government throughout the whole period of the Roman Empire, because it didn't. There were times it had 13 divisions. There are times it had 8 or 9. It varied. But this shows, 10 shows the general picture of the Roman Empire. It'd be similar in a way to your 10 toes on the image. It strikes about an average of 10. I mean, if you get specific, if you're soul-minded, you can discredit that by showing that, Rome never had consistently 10 small governments and so on. But you see, if you're trying to understand it, it's a little different. You can appreciate, in a picture, you can't make allowance for every variation that took place in history. So you just try to strike something that, took place throughout the Roman experience, and now there probably are more than 10 in Europe. There are more than 10 divisions at the present time. But be that as it may, it shows the general picture of the European Empire. So you see that this government, this Roman Empire, was to continue under 7 successions of government, and apparently this thing continues after the 7 heads disappear off the scene. In other words, the beast outlives the heads. That's what we have now. We have Europe actually without a universal government over Europe. Isn't that right? You don't have any particular government that, as it were, rules over Europe. You don't have any civil government that is over it. With the passing of Hitler, his was the last, and it was a short-lived thing. We'll get into that too later. And this dragon is up and on the scene up until the time that 3 unclean spirits come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and so on. Even though there is no head for the beast to have a mouth for the frog to come out of at the time that it takes place, according to my theory. But in detail, you can't show everything. And the last head is gone, but we still believe that the mouth, the frog-like spirits are yet to come out of the, as it were, mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast and the false prophet. See, they're all related. We can't separate these things completely, because you notice the dragon and the old leopard-like beast is on the scene up until the end, until they're cast alive into the lake of fire. The whole thing goes down together. Now, of course, the latter part of Revelation 12 is... maybe we'd better pause right here and stop for a minute and have a recess for about 5 minutes.